Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Aditi.
And today on the pod, we are going to discuss Michael Cohen and just how disgusting the Trump administration is. And then we have, of course, Dickwad of the Week and our action items. So, Aditi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I'm good. So I'm sure you have all noticed we have a new special guest host for this week. So can you tell us a little about yourself?
Yes. Well, the first thing I should say is that I'm on the East Coast. So we had a bit of a difficult time. We ended up having some challenges getting our timing right to get this together. But in addition to being on the East Coast, I am a lawyer, an activist, and a writer. I was your guest on your last episode. Yes. And I am the host of the Self Care Sundays podcast. And I'm really excited to be bothering my family less and bothering your listeners more with my analysis of politics.
Yes, I know. It's really the best part is you get it out. Yes. So again, thank you for joining us on short notice. And the difficulties that she was referring to are all my fault because no, I said 8 p.m. and then just assumed that we were both on West Coast time because everyone lives on the West Coast, right? And yeah. So it was a little bit of confusion, but we're here. We're ready. So let's jump right in.
Totally.
Hi, Hellions. Before we get into the rest of the episode, I want to take a few minutes to discuss some feedback that we got on last Monday's episode, Men Are Fucking Trash. Unfortunately, Drexel is not here with me to discuss it, but I am going to do my best to relay the feedback and respond to it. I tried to pick feedback that I felt best encapsulated the thoughts and feelings expressed by many of our listeners. We got emails and Facebook messages and Twitter messages, and I want to take this opportunity again to thank everyone who took the time and emotional energy to reach out and give us feedback on the episode. It is such a huge part of what we do here at Hellbent, and our listeners are so willing and able to engage in these thoughtful, intelligent discussions, and I am just blown away and so grateful for that. So I'm going to read a couple, and this is going to be a longer section than normal, but I think it's important to discuss. So the first one is an email that I got from Shauna. She said, I'm going to do my best to be nuanced, but I must admit I was disappointed in Drexel during this last pod about Eric Schneiderman. Either we believe the women and their accounts or we don't. But to say you believe them and then a few sentences later to say you don't know which pieces of what he said, she said are true because you weren't there is fundamentally incongruent. The accusations against Schneiderman are pretty horrific, not just uncomfortably gray like Franken and Ansari. Violence is unacceptable, full stop. There should never be a question about that. And yes, we can and should separate the office from the person. But the person can shape the office just as much as the office shapes the person. Look at how degenerate the entire White House has become because of the man in charge. The policies may have been good or even great, but how much better could it have been if he actually lived the values he advocated for? Melania Trump may care about cyberbullying, but you have to sweep around your own front door. Schneiderman did the right thing in stepping down, but the hypocrisy is what makes it extra painful. Allies and advocates are supposed to try harder and be better than the average person. To me, this is what being an ally is. Of course, we are all human and we all make mistakes, but there is a difference between making an inappropriate comment and choking someone. And I just want to take a moment to say, and I'll say this next, Katie pointed out that the language that domestic violence advocates suggest that we use is strangulation. So there's a difference between making inappropriate comments and strangling someone. She goes on, a good person maybe can't see all the lines in a very complicated world. And yes, they deserve space to learn, but this one should be neon clear. His policies will stand and they have certainly helped many people, but women have reached a point where our male allies need to be better or they need to step aside and hand their power over, especially when it comes to assault and violence. Can Schneiderman be redeemed? Maybe, if his actions do the work over time. But I, like Devin, am not interested in an apology tour. Our next email is from Katie. Like I said, Katie is the one who pointed out that the language that we should use is strangulation versus choking. And thank you for that. And I think I mentioned that on Thursday. Katie said, I'm going to be very frank. I was deeply disappointed and frankly angered by some of the things that Drexel said during the discussion on Tuesday's episode about Eric Schneiderman. I went back and forth about whether to write y'all, and my thinking went like this. Oh, Katie, you're overreacting. Don't be so sensitive. Don't criticize. Hellbent is usually great. Let it go. But this is exactly the kind of thinking that prevents women from speaking out about harassment and abuse and all sorts of mistreatment. And if I may borrow a phrase from another favorite podcast, fuck politeness. And I just want to add a note here. I never want anyone to feel like they can't give us feedback. And you are not overreacting and you're not being too sensitive. And just because, and I appreciate this, that we're usually great doesn't mean we don't fuck up and we deserve to be called out on when we do fuck up. Katie continues, the allegations against Schneiderman are absolutely horrifying. He's a monster. I hope we all agree on that. And when I heard Drexel refer to his behavior as personal transgressions, he said, she said, and pretty shitty, I was absolutely floored. The type of violent behavior described is not a personal transgression. He was violent, controlling, and abuser of power, as Devin rightly pointed out that he used his position as New York AG to intimidate women. Strangling, in particular, is one of the indicators of lethality in domestic violence. I absolutely understand the instinct to point out the great things that Schneiderman did as New York AG and separate this from the allegations. But for that to be the first instinct, to immediately jump to that, is disturbing and dismissive. I don't think that anyone is arguing that his actions undo everything he accomplished as New York AG. We're simply saying that his behaviors are abhorrent and he should no longer serve in the office. That's it. It doesn't need an asterisk or a footnote. Drexel, I also wanted to address one other thing that you said, which is that you don't get attached to people or stories. I respect that. But here's the thing with men like Schneiderman and Franken. People did get attached to them, especially women, because they specifically positioned themselves as champions of women. Given the political environment that we're in, a lot of women want good male allies because they seem to be few and far between. I hope you can understand why a lot of us did put men like Schneiderman on a pedestal without faulting us for that. And that is why, therefore, this feels like an even bigger betrayal. So the next one is from Cindy, who is in our Facebook group. She said, I've been less engaged and excited to listen to the podcast lately. I miss the dynamic between Sarah and Devin. I do too. And I know it's a lot for Devin to handle on her own, but the various guest hosts and her solo did more for me than the current format. And then next one, Kate from the Facebook group said, quote, the thing is, I'm not here for well-rounded conversation on the issues instead of an echo chamber of thought. I started listening to Hellbent because I was really fucking angry about what was happening in this country. And with Hellbent, I could metaphorically hang out with thoughtful, intelligent feminists who were just as angry as I was and not hesitant to express that. So again, I want to thank everyone for their feedback. Like I said, I tried to pick ones that I felt were all-encompassing or conveyed the thoughts and feelings of many of the people. But if I didn't get your thoughts or feelings with these pieces of feedback, please feel free to let me know and we can continue to discuss this. And on a personal, not a personal note, but editorially, I should have scrapped the conversation and I take full responsibility for that. I knew that the conversation did not go the way I had intended it to, but I wanted to make sure I was honest about what we had talked about. I realize now that it did not reflect the values of Hellbent or gel with the message and mission that Sarah and I set out to put in the world. Going forward, I promise to make sure that our conversations on the show are more nuanced, concise, and, well, angry, because I'm fucking pissed. And I'm going to say again what should have been the thesis of that entire episode. Fuck you, Eric fucking Schneiderman. Fuck you and your slimy fucking face for the damage you have done to women, our party, and basic human decency. You can fuck right the hell off forever. Do not do an apology tour. I don't want to fucking hear it ever. Go fuck yourself. And that's what I should have said. I am so sorry that the message came off so skewed. What we say as people, as feminists, as hosts, is never about intent, but impact. And I am so sorry that the impact was so hurtful to many of our listeners. And I will make an effort going forward to make sure that this never happens again. Again, thank you for all of your feedback, and I welcome any more that you have. Going forward, Drexel is going to work full-time on his new podcast that we're still planning on launching called Bleep What You Heard with Drexel Hurd and Friends. I think that the concept and the format is fresh and interesting, and it's going to focus on the educational side of politics and, you know, understanding the nuances of the Democratic Party and issues of the day with thoughtful discussions and interviews with people in the Democratic Party. So I think it's going to be a very interesting podcast, and I hope that you enjoy that going forward. In the interim, until Sarah comes back, because we are all waiting for her to come back, and I'm hoping and praying that she feels up to it soon. But Sarah, there's no pressure. I want you to know that your health is of the utmost importance, and that I want you to get better first. But I will be speaking. I will be asking the smartest women I know to guest host for me, just like I did today. I was so lucky to get Aditi to be my guest host for this episode. She is so fantastic and so smart. And I hope that you enjoy the conversations that I got to have, honestly, today. And going forward, I want you to know that I want this to be a feminist conversation with two female hosts, because we deserve a voice in the political conversation. And I want to make sure that that happens. I could sing Varsha's praises for hours. She is an amazing research assistant and is absolutely essential to putting out our show every week. We got so lucky. Varsha fell right into our lap, and she is amazing. Oftentimes, though, it's not easy to find the person you need to run your business. ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire, because 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. So you actually have a shot at finding your Varsha. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive, so you never miss a great match. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. And right now, Hellions can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/hellbent. That's ZipRecruiter.com/hellbent. One more time, ZipRecruiter.com/hellbent. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, so let's jump right in. I think first we're going to talk about Michael Cohen. So there's been a lot in the news with this guy. Can you give us a little bit of background?
Sure. So Michael Cohen is Trump's personal lawyer, although that seems to be an under and an overstatement at the same time. Right? It's an understatement because he seems to be involved in a lot of functions that lawyers are not typically involved in, like paying off mistresses, although I don't know, I guess it depends on the kind of lawyer you are. And it also seems to be an overstatement because he doesn't seem to be particularly, I'm trying to find a really nice word for bright. He doesn't seem to be great at managing his client's exposure, which is literally the function of a lawyer.
Right.
So he's a strange and interesting individual.
Yeah, he's definitely a character. I mean, insofar that it feels like everyone in this political stage is a character. Like, we are living in a reality show. It feels like that, you know? And you get these, like, almost caricature-type people playing these, like, it's so weird, right?
It's really weird. And at the same time, it feels like that feeling is almost dangerous to me, because if we think we're in a movie, like, maybe we don't feel like, oh my God, I need to do something. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so that's the thing that always makes me feel nervous, where I'm like, I literally couldn't write this shit. Like, I couldn't make it up. If it was in a movie, you'd be like, I don't know, man, that's a little too on the nose. That's a little too out there.
Oh, this would get rejected for Law and Order. This would not be an episode of Law and Order.
You couldn't pitch it on Scandal. It's too crazy. But it, But that feeling of it feeling like a spectacle, I worry, makes us all like want to sit there and watch the train on fire instead of being right. like, oh shit, the train's on fire. We should take a water ride.
Like, focus on the fucking fire. Come on.
That's real. Like, I know it's a crime. The flames are big, but we have to put it out. We live on that train.
Yeah. And, you know, so this story is complicated and weird. So I'm going to give you like the 30-second recap as far as I understand it. And then since you are actually a smart and talented lawyer, you can tell me if I got anything wrong. But basically, Cohen set up this weird little company called Essentials Consultants LLC, whose primary function when it was set up was to pay Stormy Daniels $130,000 in conjunction with a non-disclosure agreement. However, what we're now learning, because Stormy Daniels' lawyer, Michael Avenatti, has released documents, is that Essential Consultants LLC also took in money from a couple of different large companies like AT&T, Novartis, which is a drug company, Korea Aerospace, and then also a company that's linked to a Russian oligarch named Viktor Vekselberg. And we were just talking about how this is a movie, and that is the best Bond villain name of them all. Jesus. And so it's just such a fucking mess. And so then Essential Consultants LLC also paid Michael Cohen personally. And that's just after the whole Stormy Daniels thing. So this weird, seemingly unrelated Stormy Daniels story has transformed into a monster of a corruption scandal, which is basically the framework as I understand it.
I think what you're saying is mostly right, except there are a couple of like details that I'm not sure are completely know yet. So okay. We don't know why Essential Consultants was set up. We don't know if the function was to pay off Stormy Daniels or if it was for some other reason. And what you're saying about you know, how money came in through Columbus Nova, which is, as you're saying, the company of the Russian oligarch, and then these other large American and international companies. It's true. And then money went out. But there's an interesting graphic, which I can find and we can put in the show notes, that kind of illustrates how money came in and money went out. And it's not really one-to-one, and the dates don't really add up. So it's like we're getting pieces of information. It's very much like a puzzle right now. So we don't know exactly like what money came out, what money went out, and to whom. And so it's a little bit, we're missing a lot of information right now. But what we do know is that this is highly unusual and odd, and that there was information released, for example, about AT&T that said that Michael Cohen was specifically hired to advise on business they had before the federal government, which was the AT&T Time Warner merger. Similarly, right. Novartis, it's come out, specifically hired him to advise on, again, matters that they had before the federal government. And so it seems like, at least for the large companies, Michael Cohen was hired due to his relationship with the president. And obviously, Michael Cohen's payment of Stormy Daniels shortly before the election was also related to the president. And I am continuing to refer to him as the president because we should understand how crazy it is that the president is.
Right?
I'm not doing it because I'm like happy Donald Trump is the president. I'm just like, we need to understand that this is the person with the launch codes.
Right.
And so it's all a little bit of a mess. And I think the reason it feels a little bit unusual is because we don't typically see this in the United States, but we see this in countries all over the world. And the term I have heard being used to describe this is something called autocratic capture, which is basically when an autocrat starts to treat the government as a means to enrich themselves, but it's not just like one individual, it becomes systemic. So it's, you know, Donald Trump makes fun of Amazon, their shares start tanking, and lo and behold, other companies start being like, hey, we need to go grease that guy's bread so that way, you know, butter that guy's bread so that way he doesn't do that to us. And so it starts to feel like, you know, it's not one individual who's making bad moves. It's just everyone, it becomes system-wide and it becomes how the government functions. And it feels weird for us here in the US because we haven't had this since around the 1920s. But this is how, you know, lots of countries function. India functions like this in a lot of ways. Egypt functions like this in a lot of ways. And I don't know that those are countries we necessarily like to aspire to be more like.
Well, so, first of all, butter this guy's bread is my new favorite saying of all time. So thank you for that.
I borrowed it. It's not mine.
It's so good, though. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely there definitely feels like there's this like Democratic backsliding side to all of this, where we know corruption and politics go hand in hand. And, you know, even when we think that the government is running squeaky clean, it's not, right? Like, there's always been some level of, you know, with lobbyists, with money, with dark money, there's always kind of a dark web of politics, which, fine, but this feels like it's now out in the open. It's really creating, like you said, this feeling where like one company shares start to tank, so these other companies are like, oh well, we better get on board, and it just feels systemic. It feels like that's just how it works now. So I have a question for you that's a little on the legal vein.
Mm-hmm.
Is it illegal for Michael Cohen to sort of pitch himself as a consultant to these companies when it's really obvious what he's selling is access? But can they hire him as a quote unquote consultant, or is it illegal?
As far as I can tell, he's not done anything that's illegal. He's just done stuff that's icky.
Okay.
And so it is not illegal to pitch yourself as a consultant. It's not, I would say, even unusual for someone with a close relationship with people in power to use those relationships as a way to kind of, I don't know if advertise is the right word, but as a way to make themselves more relevant. But I think this is like extremely blatant in a way mm-hmm. that we haven't seen before. And I don't know if that makes it necessarily worse, right? Like, oh, you're more honest about it. I don't know if that makes me hate you anymore. I don't know if that's a bigger problem. Like, you're more honest about it. I don't know. Maybe in some way that's a good thing. It's kind of weird. It does feel less intelligent for sure. I don't think it's, as far as I can tell, it's not unlawful. It's just kind of yucky.
Right.
And to be clear, like, you know, something being illegal doesn't mean that it's right. Laws are wrong. Slavery was legal in the United States for a long time. Right. That doesn't mean that it was the right law. And laws change, right? Like, laws are not set in stone. But as our current legal system stands, I haven't been able to figure that he's done anything illegal as of yet. Although I think a lot of it depends on, well, was he able to actually get them access? What did that access look like? Because right. because he's outside of government. He never worked for the government. But, you know, if those things turn into bribes and there's a way to show that it's a bribe, that seems to be a little bit different, right? Or if it's right. or if you can kind of make out a case for extortion, that would seem to be a little bit different. And I don't think we have anything that makes that clear yet.
So I also have another question. Again, I love that I have you now on the show because I'm like, I have so many questions.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's my understanding that Essential Consultants LLC was set up right around the time that Stormy Daniels was paid for the NDA. And you said that we don't know why Essential Consultants was set up. Does it really matter why? Does it matter if it was set up for the Stormy Daniels thing or specifically to create, you know, this access or this consulting, maybe not illegal, but definitely gross thing? Does it matter either way?
I don't think so. I think it maybe only matters to the extent that someone is trying to, you know, prove something, like to the extent that I could imagine someone is trying to prove intent of a crime. And if you're trying to prove intent of a crime, you can say, well, of course you were intending to commit a crime. You set up this new organization in, you know, very proximate timing to something, but we don't have a crime. So, I mean, I guess maybe intent could matter in that context, in a more like legal formalistic context, but I don't know that we have any reason to think it matters at this point in time.
Yeah, you know, and I think the other thing about this case, like I like how you kind of put it, like maybe it's not illegal, but it's definitely icky. I feel like moving forward, when we create this, how can I put this? The country elected Trump, even though he said that he grabbed women by the pussy. And I feel like that sets a tone and sets a precedent. And I feel like if this isn't necessarily legal, but or if they somehow get away with it, I don't know exactly what getting away with it would look like necessarily. But if that's the case, I feel like this sets a really dangerous precedent going forward. So it's sort of on the autocratic capture side of this, where this just becomes the norm. And even when Trump is out of office, there's still this lingering understanding that this is maybe not acceptable, but you can get away with it. I feel like there's something like fundamentally wrong with that. I mean, do you think that this is something that's going to stick around?
So I think there are a couple things to what you just said. One thing I want to be really clear about is that grabbing someone by the pussy is illegal. That's not just that, that is really illegal. I want to make sure that that's explicit and clear. But to your broader question about, when we talk about erosion of norms, what we're talking about is that it's not just a thing of that, oh, you know, maybe it continues to be gross, but like it becomes, but it continues to happen. The problem is that as things continue to happen, they stop becoming gross. You know, that, yeah, because it erodes the norm. That's the problem. So when we look at, you know, when we look at historically at instances of, you know, I don't know, sex discrimination, racial discrimination, whatever, it's like no one is born hating people, but people get used to it and people give up pieces of their humanity to dehumanize others and they start to feel comfortable of it. You know, you look at, I've been thinking about the lynching memorial a lot, but there are like pictures, postcards of people attending lynchings in their Sunday best. Like it's a normal thing. Like that doesn't just happen. That it's a norm that erodes over time about the dignity of your fellow humans. And right. That was something that has been long baked and established in our society. This is a little bit different. We've gone through periods of where we've had more or less corruption. There's actually a corruption museum in Albany, in New York. So we've certainly had it in the US before, but
I guess that gives me a little bit of faith. We can come back from it. If it's something that fluctuates, if it's something that, you know, we see more and less of over time, I guess then theoretically this could be something that we come back from, that it doesn't become normalized to the point where it's no longer icky.
Yeah, I think that's right. But what matters is what the consequence, I think it matters a few things. One is like what the public response is and also what the consequences are. So I think what's promising about this particular situation is that we're seeing like AT&T and Novartis and other companies really have hell to pay for it, that they've made public statements apologized to their employees. People have gotten fired over this. Like there is clearly a price to pay for engaging in right. this type of behavior and playing the game of the autocrat. And I think that sense a really good and clear message to other companies that might think, hey, I have some business before the federal government. Maybe I should quote unquote hire Michael Cohen to do some quote unquote consulting for me. That it creates a little bit of fear that like, yeah, maybe that will have some effect, but if it comes out, it's going to be much worse for me. And so on balance, it's not worth it. And so I think the fact that there is a consequence that was exacted demonstrates two things. One is that it's not normal right now. And, you know, people have a strong reaction to it. And two, it sets a precedent and consequence that when other companies are trying to figure out this math and whether they should engage in this kind of behavior, we're hoping the answer leans towards no.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. I guess, because, you know, for me, like when you said consequences, I immediately think, okay, what's the consequence for Michael Cohen? But it's a good point that consequences, especially immediate ones for these companies, are really going to affect how the public takes other companies. Basically, if your reputation is at stake, are you willing to take that gamble? And so as long as we keep those reputations at stake, it's not even just about Michael Cohen and Trump and whoever else is involved, but it's actually about the companies and their shareholders, which I guess, especially in this capitalist society, is very, very powerful and a good way to keep things together.
Yeah. And it's often the case, right? Like there are always bad actors in any society. There are always bad actors. We're in a unique situation right now because our bad actors are in positions of power, but even then they only have so much power as we give them. You can't rule without, it's a democracy. You can't rule without the consent of the governed, right? You can't engage right. in behavior that we will not allow you to engage in. And so companies have in this administration, you know, played a really interesting function and been a really interesting lever. You see a lot of different social movements from gun safety activists to people who are part of the resistance, really focusing their ire on companies and boycotting companies to change behavior, because it seems right now that corporations are more responsive to public pressure than politicians.
Which I guess, again, in this particular situation, in this particular moment, makes sense because Trump is trying to play this autocratic game. He's not trying to live in a democracy. So it would make sense that he's not responding to the public outcry as much as like as much as the company responding to its consumers.
That's right. And I think that, you know, like, it's interesting you mentioned, like, what's the consequence for Michael Cohen? I mean, I don't see Michael Cohen as being particularly responsive to pressure, right? Like, it's very hard when someone is shameless to shame them into behaving well.
But, right, which is why Stormy Daniels is beating Trump at his own game.
Yeah, there was actually a great article on the first porn president in The Atlantic where they said the exact reason why she's such a formidable opponent to him is because she doesn't have shame.
Because that's normally his tactic, is to go after the people going after him and shaming them and making them feel bad for doing it. And Stormy Daniels was like, fuck off. I don't give a fuck. Like, what do you want from me? She's playing his game better than he is. And I think that you can also say the same about her lawyer, Michael Avenatti, whom I was actually just talking to Varsha, a research assistant, about this. I was like, here's the thing. I don't like Michael Avenatti. I've watched all of his interviews, and I think he's kind of like the stereotypical slimy LA lawyer. But like, he is, you know, and he's obviously like hungry for attention and going on all these shows, and is very like slick in his like media presence and all, you know, whatever. So I don't want to like have dinner with him, but he is really good at what he's doing. He cannot be shamed, and he is really following through on finding this information and creating a real case against the people in this situation.
It's so interesting that you said you don't like him, because every lawyer I know is obsessed with him. And the thing is, I think that most of us, well, I won't speak for other lawyers, I'll just speak for myself, but at least it's the impression I'm getting is everyone thinks he's playing a game. No one actually thinks he's like media hungry, because he's not a guy who's been on TV a lot before with past clients.
That's also true. Yeah.
Like, no one thinks that he, you know, he's never worked with someone who was an adult film star in the past. Like, he really strikes me as a person who's trying to do the best he can for his client. And in this particular situation, this is what's best. And I think the reason that lawyers I know seem to have a lot of admiration for him is because he's willing to be creative in the sense of using the media or beat Trump at his own game. Like, he's willing to be creative and nimble to playing in a really weird and different set of rules, and is very strategic about when he releases information, how he releases information, which shows he'll go on. He has this whole thing about how the only show he'll go on Fox right now is Hannity. Like, he's very, he seems very like intelligent and also unafraid, really into like the high stakes, really into like, you know, lawyers seem to be risk averse, and he seems to be really, embracing the high stakes nature of what he's doing.
I love that. I've never thought of that, but you're right. Like, what is he? Because he's not been on TV. I've never seen a local ad for him, right, in Los Angeles. So, you know, you'd think if he was so media hungry, he'd be all over. Mm-hmm. So maybe he is playing a role, and I'm supposed to not like him, right? Like, is maybe that's part of it.
He doesn't care if you like him. I think, really has an audience of one, which is Trump.
Right. Right. And so he's because he does. He taunts him, like straight up taunts him.
Yeah, he's not on TV for you. He's on TV for Trump.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I love that. I have never thought of that. But that is fascinating. John Kelly gave an interview to NPR about immigration policy. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because John Kelly doesn't really speak to the media a whole lot. And when he does, it's not usually a source like NPR. It's kind of the mainstream media, to quote Sarah Palin, which I'm sorry, I quoted Sarah Palin.
That's but okay. She's alive still.
She's alive. She's a person. So he almost said something not awful about immigration, but don't worry, everyone. He is just as awful as everyone else. He couldn't help himself. He said, I'm going to quote this whole passage because I think it's really important to like talk about this a little bit and kind of tease out what he's talking about.
Yep.
So he said, quote, "Let me step back and tell you that the vast majority of the people that move illegally into the United States are not bad people. They're not criminals." And that's the part where he almost wasn't a terrible dickwad. Mm-hmm. "They're not MS-13. Some of them are not. But they're also not people that would easily assimilate into the United States, into our modern society. They're overwhelmingly rural people in the countries they come from. Fourth, fifth, sixth grade educations are kind of the norm. They don't speak English. Obviously, that's a big thing. They don't speak English. They don't integrate well. They don't have skills. They're not bad people. They're coming here for a reason, and I sympathize with the reason. But the laws are the laws, and a big name of the game is deterrence.
Can I just go? I'm like ready. Let me just. All right. I'm cracking my knuckles. I'm just ready to go. So let's go. Let's go kind of one step at a time. Okay. Let me step back and tell you that the vast majority of people that move illegally into the United States are not bad people. So this sentence is factually inaccurate. The reason this sentence is factually inaccurate is the majority of the people who are in the country illegally did not move here illegally. The majority of them came into the country with legal status and overstayed their visas. So this is factually inaccurate. They're not criminals. That is correct. They're not MS-13. That's also correct. Some of them are not. That's also probably correct. But they're also not the people that would easily assimilate into the U.S. into our modern society. This is factually incorrect because there have been studies done that show that this wave of immigrants, which is largely Latino, is assimilating at the same rates as every other past wave of immigrants. So the Irish, Italians, Poles, whatever, like whoever, that they are integrating into our society and assimilating into our society, quote unquote, at the same rate in terms of, you know, learning the language, getting jobs, kids in schools, participating in civic institutions at the same rate as past generations. There's a reason we have a Little Italy here in New York. Because this is a common thing that happens with every wave of immigrants. They're overwhelmingly rural people in the countries that come from 4th, 5th, 6th, 8th grade educations are kind of the norm. So I don't know off the top of my head statistically whether this is true about the rural part. I suspect that it may not be true, but I don't know that. What I do know is that when he's referencing the education levels, a third of Americans read at a 5th grade reading level. A third of, like, American-born Americans read at a 5th grade reading level. So I think before we start concerning ourselves with the level of education immigrants come into the country with, we should be concerned with the level of education people in this country have, because
Betsy DeVos is my personal nemesis.
Sentence supposes that most Americans have more education than this. And you know, we have a big gulf. We have a third of Americans who are college educated and a third of Americans who can't read above a 5th grade reading level. So, and by the way, it's the third that can't read above a 5th grade reading level that were more likely to vote for Donald Trump. So I don't know why he's decrying them. These people would be more likely to be his voters. They don't speak English, obviously. That's a big thing. That's true for vast majority of immigrants, including his ancestors who came to this country, Donald Trump's grandparents, Melania Trump when she landed in this country. So this is not unusual or unique to this wave of immigrants. They don't integrate well. They don't have skills. Again, this statement is factually false. As I said, this wave of immigrants is integrating just as well as past waves. And they obviously do have skills because they keep finding jobs. Our economy would literally collapse without them. No one wants to take the jobs that immigrants coming from South America and Mexico are taking, these low-wage farm worker jobs, landscaping jobs, like really like this hard labor work. There is a need for this work. People will say that they cannot find people to do these jobs in the United States. And those are obviously not the only immigrants coming to this country. Like we think immigrant, we think people from South America, but actually the highest rate of immigration are people who are coming from Asia. And the highest growth rate of undocumented immigrants are people who are overstaying visas from Asia. So like, the whole kind of, this is a narrative that is just false, and they're not bad people. I would agree with that statement as well. And they are also coming here for a reason. Also true. I also sympathize with that reason. The laws are the laws. That's true. As we said, the laws may not be the right laws. And
they change. They may change.
And the question of the name of the game is deterrence. What's really interesting about this is that there's not a ton of evidence that having harsher immigration laws deters people from trying to enter the country who are coming from places that they're trying to escape, because you don't like cross a desert and a river to come to a country where you think people might not want you because it would be fun or for economic prosperity. People are like fleeing and seeking asylum from war-torn places. Like, they're coming anyway. Like, you're not going to be able to deter people in that situation. What, who you are deterring, which we are finding, there's good data to back this up, is you're deterring, you know, people who are coming here for graduate school, people who are coming here for college. So kind of almost exactly the type of immigrants who I think, at least from this quote, would be considered good immigrants to him. Those are the ones you're deterring, because those are the ones who have other options. The ones who are in a desperate situation, you're just not going to be able to deter them. It requires a rational calculation where the risks outweigh the benefits. And if you're fleeing death, that's not going to be the case.
Yeah. This issue, the big name of the game is deterrence. I also was struck by that because this comes on the heels. Last week, Jeff Sessions announced a new policy that states women and their children would be separated if they were caught crossing the border illegally. And something that we talked about was, you know, and he ended this announcement with, we don't want to separate families. We don't want you to come across the border illegally. We urge you not to do so. And something that we really talked about was how I don't think the DOJ thinks that that kind of policy would stand on its legs in front of a court of law. I think this would definitely be a human rights issue. And I'm not a lawyer, but I feel like there would definitely be legal. I feel like the DOJ knows that that is not a valid thing that they can do. But I think what they're trying to do is scare people. And like you just said, deterrence is not going to work. And so to make these type of policies, to say these kind of things, to say that the name of the game is deterrence, I think is more a scare tactic for Trump's base. It's less about the immigrants themselves and more about speaking to Trump's base and making them feel like that they are following through on these tough on immigration, tough on border security things that were promised during the campaign. And that by saying these things, it's not even about creating actual policy. It's about creating a narrative that Trump is getting shit done.
Yeah, I can't answer the legal question about whether it would stand up in a court of law. I don't think we know that. I don't know the case law, but like the interesting thing here is like Jeff Sessions presumably gave the statement in English and it probably like appeared on like C-SPAN. And I would guess the majority of Americans don't even know that it happened. So I'm like, why do you think someone who John Kelly over here is saying that they don't speak English and they're at a, you know, they're at a low grade level for education. Like, where do you think they're getting this information from? Right. You think that like everyone is just really tuned into C-SPAN in other parts of the country, in other parts of the world? Like, I think not, probably. So I would agree with your hypothesis that this is highly unlikely. I mean, we see that even in the US for laws for people who are US citizens, right? About like when you change a gun law or you change a penalty on drugs, like we don't really see a deterrence effect because most people are not aware of the penalties associated with laws. And so I have no idea why I think that this would travel internationally. And I think that you're probably right that it's about kind of seeming to be fulfilling a promise and a harsh on immigrant narrative for his supporters and his base more so. And also, I think to dehumanize people. Like, I think it serves a narrative of dehumanizing people.
I think that was my next point. And I believe that you and I were talking about this last week where it's, you know, further marginalizing and vilifying groups of people is a tactic in creating authoritarian and autocratic regimes, because if you're fighting with each other, you're not fighting with the government. And so again, less than creating policy, because I don't think they're actually creating policy. They're just trying to set the narrative in the direction that they want it to go. And part of that is satisfying a certain Trump voter. And part of that is creating a wider divide and really dehumanizing. I mean, when you're talking about taking children away from their mothers, like you have to really, especially if you are a parent, and you don't have to be a parent, but you really have to dehumanize the person so fully in order to justify taking their child away that it's like almost it's we're getting into doublethink, right? And into this like sci-fi, scary, Brave New World, 1984 shit.
Yeah, I think that's all right. All everything you just said is correct in terms of, you know, what it takes to dehumanize. And but I think it's not just that authoritarians are pitting us against each other. I think that's certainly a part of it. But it's also that in countries, I'm reading Asha Monk's book right now, The People versus Democracy. In countries where populist candidates, including the U.S., have been successful, the core of their base are people who are concerned about immigration. And that's because democracies historically have done better when they are monoethnic. So in Europe, most democracies were founded as monoethnic nations. In the United States, that wasn't the case. We always have had this narrative of, you know, of being a nation of immigrants. But for a long time, we had a racial hierarchy and a racial caste system. And what we live in now, only really in the last 50 years globally, are democracies where all people have all their rights. And that creates a lot of anxiety. And it's not to kind of say that it's not to kind of like bolster the economic anxiety argument up that people are talking about. It's also this racial anxiety. And I think, you know, people will say, well, that's like a code word for because you don't want to say racism. And the reason I'm calling it anxiety is because the anxiety is real. Like the factual basis, like the economic reality does not give cause for anxiety. The social structure does not give cause for racial anxiety. Like, you're a white person, you have every privilege, you don't need to be anxious. But like, the reason it's not just racism is because it's the anxiety is real, while the kind of concerns may or may not be real.
Right. Well, there was, I talked about it a little bit a while ago, but there was an article in The Atlantic, and there was a study done at University of Pennsylvania on survey data that found basically that people who voted for Trump, self-reportedly, it was not economic anxiety. It was anxiety over their social standing and their white privilege. And so we know that when you talk about anxiety, which is very real, but it's not an economic thing. It's not about it, you know, I don't think anyone.
There is a piece of it that's economic. Like, Trump is more likely to win counties where they've seen where people are less optimistic about the future and their chances of building a better life than their parents had. But that's not necessarily supported by data. Like, in counties where they have a lot of jobs, where they're likely to see automation, or where they're not seeing growth at high rates. But that doesn't mean that people's lives are bad. It means that people are worried about the future. And whether those worries are real or not is almost not the point.
Right. And being worried about the future can mean, yes, being worried economically about the future, but also being worried about your white privilege and your social standing.
It's both. I think they feed each other because when you have a high rate of growth in the economy, you don't care if someone else is doing well because you know you're doing well too. But when you start seeing more stagnation, I think people are like, I don't know that my life is going to be better than my parents. How dare that person's life be better than their parents? And so I think that it starts to feed each other.
Well, and it's like people love government involvement and big government when it benefits them, but they hate it when it benefits other people, right? If you're helping someone else.
And also, if you're not getting ahead, you get mad that someone else is.
There's an entitlement complex.
I actually asked this question a long time ago before the election. I was talking to Chris Arnotti, who does some research on this space. And I said, like, I see like white people who have this attitude about like, why should I have to go to college? My dad didn't have to go to college. And I really just don't see that in communities of color. I see a lot of first generation college students who are like, yeah, I want to go to college because my parents didn't get to go to college. It's a really different attitude. And I think entitlement is the right word.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, Devin, why don't we do the gratitude check that you guys do on the show? What are you grateful for today?
Well, I am very grateful for our listeners. I feel like I'm grateful for our listeners a lot, but this week in particular, I'm also very grateful for Drexel. Drexel stepped in at a time where Sarah couldn't do the show anymore, and we were pretty much up Schitt's Creek, and he stepped in, and he's been a wonderful, warm, and supportive presence in my life and on the show. And last week we had a discussion about Eric Schneiderman and the allegations against him. We got some thoughtful, insightful feedback about what we talked about, how we talked about it, how Drexel talked about it. And I have to say that it was very critical, which is totally fine and we encourage, but it stayed so civil and constructive. It never got mean. It never devolved into name calling. It never devolved into anything unproductive. And I think for me, I mean, a lot of this discussion happened in our Facebook group, Dick Wads Be Gone. And I've been in Facebook groups where I'm in a mom's group. And I remember there was one conversation about the best way to wrap your baby that literally devolved into name calling in 20 comments or less. So to see this community of just such smart, engaged and thoughtful people, particularly women who are putting in the emotional investment and the emotional energy to give us this amazing feedback, I was just floored by how wonderful that was. And I am so grateful to be part of this community. That's what I'm grateful for today. What about you, Aditi?
I am grateful for something a lot less earnest, which is I'm really grateful, I think, for food today. I cooked today and I cooked yesterday, which is a habit I'm trying to build, and it's challenging. And I'm just really grateful for that feeling when you can eat and not feel stuffed, but feel full and kind of know what you put into your body and be yes. I think that was healthy. And that's a really good feeling.
You're holy shit. Did I just do something healthy?
Yeah. And Donald Trump will have many impacts on the world, but the one impact that he's had on me personally that is kind of just aggravating to me because I've allowed it to happen is my weight gain since this administration. Yeah. Because I've been working a lot and eating out a lot. And so that really sucks. And it's gotten to a point where I don't think I look all that different, but I'm feeling a little bit nervous. It's getting to a place where I'm this is not just oh yeah, but where I'm nervous about my health and I really feel like I need to make a change. And so just kind of feeling, I felt very accomplished that I cooked. So I was very grateful that I was able to do that today.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I am terrible at cooking for myself. And I swear if I didn't have Alex, I would probably eat nothing but takeout and plain buttered noodles because that's all I can manage most days.
Yeah, totally.
All right. So block five, one of my favorites of the week. It is Dickwad of the Week. And this week, the Dickwad is the entire state of Iowa. I'm sorry to anyone who lives in Iowa. Not everyone there is terrible, but I'm pretty pissed at them this week. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed an extremely restrictive abortion bill into law on Friday. And it's the so-called heartbeat legislation. And this made it through Iowa State Senate and House of Representatives. And this is the sort of bill that slips under the radar. And this is why local politics is so important. This is why you need to keep your eye on who is elected, not just federally, which are the really sexy elections. And I'm using the term sexy loosely because I'm a politics nerd and I think it's sexy. But we need to keep an eye on who's elected locally because this bill affects people who live in Iowa. And the people that you elected directly have done this. So this bans abortions once a fetal heartbeat is detectable. And that can be at about 6 weeks pregnant. As a human who has been pregnant, let me tell you, I don't think I even knew I was pregnant at 6 weeks. It's so detestable that this is something that is an actual law I get really worked up over this stuff. It's really detestable that this has been signed into law. And so they make exceptions for cases of rape, incest, or medical emergency, which I've said before, I hate this idea of medical emergency because who's deciding what's a medical emergency that warrants some sort of big exception to this restrictive bill? And, you know, State House Rep Sandy Selman said, quote, "A baby has become something we can throw away. This bill says it's time to change the way we think about unborn life." And I just take such issue with that. It puts this narrative of abortion as something that women like do for fun on Tuesday mornings, which I want to be careful not to get into this, like, abortion is such a difficult decision, because that's not always the case either. But I think when we set up this narrative of we just throw babies away and that's why we need to make these restrictive bills, we not only create a restrictive environment for abortions, which is law of the land, you are allowed to get an abortion, but we also create a narrative that women are bad people and need or unable to deal with their own lives and their own bodies, and then thus need to be legislated. So, I mean, do you have any thoughts on
this? That's the thing about this that really bothers me. I have some understanding and even empathy for the way people who are anti-choice think about this. I think if you think a fetus is a life, that abortion would be a really hard thing for you to understand. And I can understand why you would have some activism against it. But what it presumes is that women are not making these choices rationally and thoughtfully and with the aid of their doctors. It also presumes that all women are the same and in the same circumstances. And, one statistic I heard about abortion that really blew my mind was that 60% of women who have an abortion already have a child.
I love that statistic because it blows people's minds.
It blew my mind when I first heard it. And it was just this idea that, like, you know, we have a narrative and an image and a construction of who what type of people are getting abortions. And I think often those type that image is people who are younger and also, frankly, people of color. Like, there's this image of an irresponsible young person of color who was careless, got pregnant, and is now trying to, like, find their way out of that situation. And that is just a patently false image. And it's really frustrating. 1 in 3 women have an abortion over the course of their lifetime. You know, like, that's not some small group of irresponsible teenagers who people dehumanize and detest. It is really average, everyday, ordinary people. And the notion that we would control and legislate their decisions is really deplorable, particularly because we don't do anything even remotely equivalent to men. If we passed a law saying that, like, you know, you can only have penile pumps and these very specific circumstances, everyone would think that that's kind of crazy and the argument would be that, well, yes, this is just a good direction, but every situation is different. We should really not interfere with a doctor and a patient trying to figure out what's healthy and what's safe. And I just have no idea why that doesn't apply in the context of an abortion.
Exactly. Right. It really goes back to this idea that women somehow need to be told how to run their life. And it really creates this, you know, we talked a lot about dehumanization today, and it really dehumanizes women and the autonomy they have over their own bodies. Again, and I feel like I glossed over this a little bit, it is legal to get an abortion in the United States of America up until your second trimester. Yeah. And so laws like this, you know, this is why a lot of people that I've talked to who are abortion advocates are not worried about the anti-choice activists trying to overturn Roe v. Wade. They're like, that's not how this is going to go down. They are going to create bills that get around Roe v. Wade. And that's how they're going about this. And this is one very clear example of that strategy in action.
Although this bill, it seems, is unconstitutional. And I believe that, you know, someone from the DNC actually said as much, that this unconstitutional bill is nothing but a thinly veiled attack on Iowa's most women's most basic rights and freedoms. And that was DNC's media director, Elizabeth Renda. And, like, that's true. As far as I can tell, this bill does not seem to fall within the confines of Roe v. Wade. But what it does do is it has a lot of people wasting a lot of time, energy, money, and resources fight it. Yeah. instead of further advancing reproductive justice and access to healthcare for women.
It also normalizes, you know, now that we've had a 6-week abortion ban, then all of a sudden, wait, does a 10-week ban not sound so horrible? Like, it's not 6 weeks. Like, there's definitely like a slope that we start to go down in terms of what is acceptable. And that's also a strategy I think that's employed here, where it's like, what is the most restrictive, just unconstitutional hot mess we can do? And then everything else sounds like kind of reasonable.
It's that. I think that's very right. And that's like very much a theory of change that exists. And I think that there's also just a feeling of like it to just exhaust your opponent, right? Like
yes.
that, like people will just get tired. And, you know, frankly, abortion is not like top of mind for most people because most people are not having abortions every day. Like that's not how the world works. And right. so it becomes really exhausting for people to be galvanized around this. And I don't know, it just like, and what's weird to me about people who are anti-choice as well is like, they're never the same people who are like, we need more access to sex education and birth control. Cause like, then it would at least be coherent to me that I would be like, you don't like abortion. I get that. I don't think anyone who's even pro-choice likes abortion. I think people right. think it should be like an available, safe option, but it's never the people who are vehemently anti-abortion being like, we need to do everything possible to make sure no one ever needs an abortion. That would be coherent. That would make sense to me. That's what Reagan did and right. said. And like that made sense at least. Like this version doesn't make any sense.
I know. I always say if I were an anti-choice activist, I would literally be in the street like throwing IUDs and condoms at people.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I feel like if you want, you can't have it both ways. You just fucking can't.
I mean, and to try to have it both ways, you really have to just like deny the factual basis that we like know, for example, abstinence-only education does not stop people from having sex. It delays the age they lose their virginity by about 2 years, but really drastically increases the chances that they'll get an STD or have an unplanned pregnancy. So it's like, you know, we've kind of done that experiment. Like we can kind of look at it and see whether or not it works. Like it's not a theoretical conversation at this point. Like right. same thing when we, you know, when you have lack of access to healthcare and maternal medicine, as we did in Texas during the whole women's health issue, as that was going on, we saw maternal morbidity increase. We know in countries where women don't have access to safe abortions, women are much more likely to die during childbirth. So to me, it's just like, there's like, this is not a hypothetical debate. Like there's good information out there. And I think we should do what works. And we, by the way, we're currently in like the year with like the lowest number of abortions. The number of women having abortions keeps decreasing. And the biggest reason for that we found post ACA has been access to birth control, because birth control is free under right. the ACA. So it's like, I just don't understand where you're like, if I don't want women to have abortions, why would I not do everything possible based on the facts and evidence available to me to assure that they don't need abortions? It doesn't make sense.
It really doesn't. But I mean, come on.
When has that stopped anyone?
What has that stopped anyone? All right, Aditi, last but not least, let's do some action items. So something our listeners can do after they listen to the show. And today is Mother's Day. We're recording on Sunday night. And in honor of that, I would like to call out an organization called National Bailout. And you can find them at nomoremoneybail.org. Every Mother's Day, and it's obviously Mother's Day now, so we're a little late on this, but in the week leading up to Mother's Day, organizations, this is from the website, quote, organizations in dozens of cities across the country will bail out as many mothers as possible who otherwise would spend Mother's Day in a cell simply because they cannot afford bail. National Black Mamas Bailout Day will give incarcerated mothers an opportunity to spend Mother's Day with their families and build community through gatherings that highlight the impact of inhumane and destructive bail practices on our communities. We bail out mamas in all of our varieties, queer, trans, young, elder, and immigrant. This is a fantastic organization that is working to stop the cycle of women in particular being in prison just because they can't afford bail and don't have access to that kind of capital. And then for Mother's Day in particular, they always work to bail out as many mothers as possible to spend time with their families. So it's a really great organization, nomoremoneybail.org. You can donate or get involved with the organization for the future. So that is it for us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me as a guest host today, Devin.
Yes, thank you so much for jumping in. This is honestly, like, you answered so many questions and you got my brain juices flowing. I love it.
I'm so glad.
And I will be back here on Thursday with a very special guest. Have a great day and raise some hell.